Hey guys, if you're looking for something to do this December, January, or February, if your hunting is over and you're looking for an awesome adventure, come check us out. Come hunt either deer or javelina with me and the Days in the Wild crew here in Arizona. Check out the website, daysinthewild.com. Check out my blog, johnstallone.me, for specials. Or just get a hold of me through social media and we can see if we can put something together for you. It's a fun time, lots of great experiences, over-the-counter tags for deer archery, and some leftover tags right now for javelina. So give me a call or hit me up on social media and we'll see if we can put something together for you. Hi, welcome to Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Today we're going to discuss knives. I've owned a bazillion over the years, and I've tried just about everything, and I've never really educated myself on it. So this was actually one of the few podcasts that came from me where I wanted to learn more about it. So I reached out to Troy Hellman at Benchmade. And he's agreed to come on and educate us a little bit about it. So, what's going on, Troy?
Not much, man. I'm honored that this is one that you sought out yourself. Excited to be here, and yeah, more than happy to nerd out on some knives with you.
Sweet. So, before we jump into the questions that I had, why don't you give us a little rundown about yourself first?
Sure. Grew up on the East Coast in Virginia, so big whitetail hunter growing up. My dad's a big bow hunter, so that was kind of the precedent that was set in our family. I've got two brothers, and so growing up bow hunting with them was just an absolute blast. And my dad's originally from the Northwest, so he spent a lot of time coming out to Washington and Oregon. And at a young age, I knew that was kind of where I wanted to be. So as soon as I wrapped up college, packed up the truck, the dog, and then girlfriend, now wife, and made our way out to Oregon. I'm here in Portland and started working for Benchmade Knife Company. And it's the rest is kind of history, man. It's been great. You just kind of an outdoorsman's paradise up here.
Nice. That's awesome. What kind of led you to... aside for the love of the outdoors, what kind of led you to the knife industry?
I'd been working for Cabela's, and I was managing their knife counter, optics, and archery shop. And so that was really the first time that I started to dive deep into knife manufacturing and just the quality, fit, and finish of different knives. And being right here, so Portland's kind of the hub for production knife manufacturing. A big part of that is the fact that Oregon has very lax knife legislation and has had lax knife legislation for a long time. And then also a lot of the aerospace industry is up in the Northwest, and we use a lot of common materials with the aerospace industry. So you've got five heavy hitter production knife manufacturers all within a 10-15 mile radius of each other. So there's a lot of competition. It's a popular topic. It's a popular item. And I just kind of fell in love with them. So once I had run my time there in the store, I was kind of sick of working retail hours, and saw an opening at Benchmade and jumped in. And it's just been incredible. I absolutely love working for the company.
Nice. It's nice when you find a home and something that you can enjoy.
Truly. Yeah. I'm every day incredibly grateful for the opportunity. There's times I got to kind of pinch myself and realize that I'm actually getting paid for this. So it's cool.
Sweet. Well, let's jump into some knife questions.
Let's do it.
This is the broadest of them all, I think, is, what are some of the things to consider when you're buying a knife?
Yeah, that's a great question. The biggest thing for me is staying within your budget. Hunting, outdoor recreation, adventure is an expensive endeavor at the end of the day. And you're not putting yourself in a good position if you're overspending on gear. A lot of people kind of fall into the concept that they can throw more money at their gear and that will then make them a more successful hunter. And I simply don't share that view. I think you can get good with the gear that you have and stay within your means and budget and make it work. So budget's a big one for me. And then application, how you're going to be using this knife. Some people look for a very specialized design, something that's not going to come out of your pack until you have an animal on the ground. And then some people are looking for versatility, something that can do more than just process that animal. And so that plays into budget as well. Obviously, if you're looking for specialization, you're going to be carrying and buying more than one knife generally. Our knives aren't cheap. I realize that. So it can compound and become more expensive if you are leaning towards that specialization. But those are the two big hitters for me. Now it's kind of a e-commerce and online age is upon us. And so a lot of people do their shopping online. And I think it's a little difficult when it comes to understanding fit and ergonomics in hand. Just like buying a bow, you know, guys want to go into the shop, they want to shoot the bow, get a feel for it, see if it's something that their body likes and something that works for them and their geometry. And I apply that same concept to knives. I strongly urge people to get into a brick and mortar retailer and handle these knives side by side. Or if you've got friends that have knives that you're thinking about or looking at, get a chance, ask them if you can run that while you guys are quartering out an elk or whatever you might be doing in the field so that you get firsthand experience as to how that knife fits your style and whether or not it's right for you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you know what the thing about the internet is too, is like, you know, you could do a bunch of research, but it's so hard to decipher what reviews are actually reviews from people who have used these things.
Certainly.
Or somebody who's a pro staffer or somebody who's just looking to generate traffic to the website and has all these links to buying the different knives that they're talking about. And it's so hard. Like what is real? I went through this yesterday. I was looking for a garage door opener. I'm like, like, I don't know what to trust, man. It's like, yeah, it sucks. Yeah.
It's difficult. That's why I really lean on that firsthand experience. I think that is second to none. But you're right. There's a lot of noise that we need to weed through in this like digital age. And there's nothing stronger than your own opinion and experience.
Right. Right. Yeah, I know. I've been a big proponent of that since I got into the industry. I shouldn't say when I first got into it, I'm sure I was a little bit more like everybody else. I just wanted to have sponsors and I just wanted to whatever. But I quickly found out that it was more important to develop relationships with the people. Oops, sorry. Develop a relationship with the people that you felt strongly about, like about the product and you were actually benefiting from the products that you were promoting. Because of that, unfortunately, it wasn't a smart business decision for me when I had my TV show to go that route, because I passed up a lot of money that I but in the long run, I knew all the decisions I was making on the products that I was using was helping my hunting out. And that was what's most important to me, because that's what I got into it for.
Certainly. Yeah. I think I've always kind of told people in this day and age, technology's gotten so good in regards to like technical outerwear, bows, rifles, optics, the whole nine yards. And so at the end of the day, I kind of believe that a lot of this technology is more than we'll ever need. And so I personally tend to lean towards the people behind that product and who I align with, who I believe are doing a good job and kind of walking the walk, and supporting them. And so you find your own avenues, you find your own brands and the things that you love. And some of it's fluid. You change in and out year in, year out. And some of it is just rock solid static stuff that stays in your arsenal for life. You know?
Right, right.
So.
Cool. So I kind of dove into blade profiles a little bit. So explain to me a couple of different popular blade profiles, and then I want to see what your idea is. What's better for skinning, and what's better for caping, and
sure,
butchering, and whatever.
Yeah, so I'm pretty minimalist myself, and if I'm doing a backcountry hunt, naturally I'm trying to cut down on everything I've got. And I lean towards that like versatility side of things that I was talking about earlier, something that I can use from camp. I mean, cutting open mountain house, whittling sticks, picking my teeth, working up the animal, whatever it might be. And so drop points are generally your most common blade profile from a daily carry knife up to hunting. There's really nothing crazy going on there from a geometry standpoint. You still have a relatively pronounced tip that's great for kind of fine surgical work. But then you do have a larger belly on the actual sharpened edge, and that belly is essentially increasing your surface area, meaning that knife is going to stay sharp longer because you have more working edge. Behind that drop point within the hunt space, the clip point is a super traditional profile it was kind of popularized with the Bowie knife. And so it's got that taper and flare out towards the tip, and that point is more pronounced. And so those are kind of the two most popular that I'll alternate between. I generally lean more towards a more pronounced drop point myself. And I kind of use that for all of my tasks. So.
Okay. Now, as far as the actual edge. Mm-hmm. It's different types of edges, right?
Sure.
And I can't remember what they all are. I know one's like a chisel edge. One is like, maybe you know them all. I don't remember. But in front of me at one point, and I must have lost it here because I was going to ask you about the different ones. But
so a chiseled edge is essentially sharpened on one side and the backside's flat. You see a lot of chisel edges on like sushi knives where these guys are looking to be very precise and clean with their cutting. It's not as important for us as hunters, and those knives are going to dull a little bit faster. And so you have your traditional double-sided sharpened edge on most all hunting knives. Benchmade, we sharpen our knives around 17.5 degrees per side. So you're at a 35 degree inclusive angle. You'll see a lot of knives in the industry are 20 degrees per side. And so they're a little bit more obtuse in that angle. And it's all a matter of personal preference. We like the fact that our knives come out of the box capable of shaving arm hair. And that's like where I like my knives when I'm hunting. I mean, Right. Everything. And it's actually relatively easy to keep that edge with how great steel has become these days. That's really been the big change in the industry is the quality and variety of steel types that we have at our disposal. And so I kind of use the old adage, it's always easier to stay in shape than it is to get in shape. And the same concept applies to your edge. So some guys will let their knives get butter knife dull. And then at that point, they either need to switch to a different knife or they need to sit down and take a longer amount of time to bring that edge back. And so personally, as soon as I start feeling resistance or a tug on the animal that I'm working up, I'll take a break for 30 seconds to a minute, and I'll work my edge against a ceramic rod and a leather strop. That helps me refine that edge and kind of hone it back to as close to the factory edge as I can get it. I mean, we're using multi-$1,000 sharpeners in the factory. I'm using a $40 pocket sharpener in the field. So it'd be unrealistic for me to think that I can get that factory edge out of the field, but I can get darn close.
Gotcha. So actually, it's one of my questions for you. Well, let's talk about that. Since you opened the door a little bit. I mean, you're talking about a ceramic rod and a leather strap. I personally I've only carried that, like, you know, carbide and porcelain, you know, thing, little V things that you kind of run your knife through real quick.
Yeah, the pull through sharpeners.
Yeah, pull through sharpener. Thank you. You know, while I'm out in the field, one of my knives, I have a Mora knife that has a little diamond deal on the side that of the sheath that you can.
Yep.
But other than that, I've always just used the little pull through things just because it's simple, fast, and brainless, you know.
Yep.
But I'm curious to see what your thoughts on sharpening in the field and the setup that you're using now.
Yeah. A lot of people kind of get intimidated by your traditional sharpening processes. If you're to think of like a whetstone or an Arkansas stone or something like that, you're required to maintain that consistent geometry as you kind of sweep that edge against your abrasive. And so that can be tough for some people. When you start getting wonky on your geometry, you'll notice that edge will not hold as long. And so I personally run a guided field sharpener that we collaborated on with a company called WorkSharp. They're down in Southern Oregon here. Okay. And so that little guy can fit in my pack, weighs just a couple ounces. So I'll take that thing on a backcountry trip and not sweat the weight. But that little device has coarse and fine diamond abrasives, coarse and fine ceramic abrasives, and then that leather strop is kind of built in along the spine. And the cool thing about this device is that it has your 20 degree angle guides, so that you can, no matter how inexperienced you are with sharpening, just a little bit of practice and you're able to get your knife back in action very quickly and effectively.
Cool. I actually have one of their little mechanical ones to work sharp.
Yep.
With the belt.
Yeah, those things are great too. It's obviously, if you've got a camp set up and you got a generator back at camp and you got like 5-6 guys there and a lot of tags to fill, those are awesome, quick, easy ways for you to keep knives sharp. But I'm generally, like I said, running pretty minimal. And so that no electricity needed sharpener is the way to go for me. In regards to the pull-through sharpeners that you're talking about, they're great. They're, like you said, brainless. It's super easy. But the downside to them is that nowadays a lot of steels are – we're going to nerd out here for a second. A lot of steels are what's called a CPM steel or a crucible particle metallurgy steel. And it's a different process in how that steel is actually formed from your conventional steels that we've kind of grown up with. And what that does is it evenly disperses your carbides throughout that entire blade. Carbides are these microscopic, I call them like your hitman army of abrasion. They're like micro serrations. You can't see them with the naked eye, but you throw them under a microscope and they're all over the place. And so those carbides are very, very tough. They're generally a higher hardness rating than the overall blade itself. And so it's beneficial to have them evenly dispersed throughout your blade. And a lot of them will lay up against that sharpened edge. And they're doing the majority of the abrasion for you as you cut. So as you pull through those sharpeners that you're talking about, whether it be diamond or ceramic, you're essentially, no matter how steady you keep your hand, you're kind of chattering those carbides through that V. And sometimes it can pop the carbides out. Sometimes it doesn't do anything for them because they are so darn tough. And you're not getting as sharp as you could be if you were to use something like a flat lay diamond, ceramic, and leather surface. So that's kind of going down a rabbit hole there, but that's just my opinion.
Well, it's actually a rabbit hole we're going to go down here in a little bit because I'm going to ask you about steel. But so I'm curious. I'm actually just pulled up WorkSharp's website. Which is the one that you carry?
It's called the Guided Field Sharpener.
Okay.
Or GFS. They've got one, and then we have a Benchmade one. It's Benchmade colors. It's got our logo engraved or etched into the diamond plate. But they're essentially the same thing. So Whichever one. They're both incredible. They're actually cool too. You can pop those diamond surfaces off. They're magnetic. And beneath the diamond surface, we built in a broadhead tool so that you can tighten or remove broadheads off your arrow shaft. And then if you have if you're throwing that sharpener in the same pocket as your phone or GPS or whatever else you got in there that you don't want scratched up, you can flip those diamond abrasive plates inside, and so you have a slick surface on the outside. It's instead of having that like sandpaper feel rubbing against glass screens and stuff like that, you've got a very smooth surface, so it's not going to damage anything in your pack.
Sweet. Okay, yeah, I was just looking at that. That's pretty cool. It's got the leather on the outside and the ceramic and then the diamond flat.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's everything you need in a $30, $40 package.
Sweet. Very cool. So I guess since we already opened the door to steel, what's your preferred steel? Because I've had, I mean, like Knives of Alaska, those are like D2 and they're freaking impossible to put an edge on.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know. I've had so many different, I have several Benchmade knives too. And frick, I think I got everybody's knife from.
It's a slippery slope.
It is. It really is. So
steel, personal preference for me, to talk about Benchmade as a whole, we have a dedicated Hunt series of product naturally. And historically, we've used a steel called S30V. That's a CPM steel. And it was actually one of the first steels that was designed specifically for sports cutlery use. And so it's very balanced in regards to its properties. We kind of quantify the four biggest factors of a steel as edge retention, toughness, strength, and corrosion resistance. And that S30V steel is what we use across almost our entire line right now. And you're seeing it a lot in our daily carry stuff too. So it's relatively easy to sharpen, holds an edge for a long time, longer than most. It's got great corrosion resistance, and it's not so hard that it's brittle when you are using it on tougher tasks. There are stronger steels than S30V, like D2 is what Knives of Alaska uses a lot. The downside to D2 is that it's not as stainless. It's not considered a stainless steel like S30 is. So I'll be the first to admit I don't clean my knives or keep them as dry as I should a lot. And it's kind of an uphill battle here in Oregon. I hunt the west side of the state a lot. And so we're right on the coast. You've got a lot of salt in the air. There's just a lot of moisture in general. And so it's nice having a steel that I don't necessarily have to concern myself as much about in regards to keeping clean and dry. So S30 is a great option there. About 3 years ago, we introduced its big brother to the line, and that's S90V. That's another CPM steel. It's a much higher edge retention than S30, but because you're going higher on that hardness scale, it is going to be a little bit more brittle. So it's one that you want to be more mindful of if you are putting it through its paces and really kind of reefing on that thing. So that S90V is what we introduced with the Altitude. The Altitude is a skeletonized fixed blade, and that's a very specialized knife. I absolutely love the thing. It's 2 ounces with the sheath, so it weighs nothing. And I just keep that thing in my kill kit until I've got something on the ground, and that's the only time I pop it out.
Yeah, I actually saw that in your profile picture. You're holding that up.
I'm a big advocate, man. It's a great knife, and it's really kind of opened the doors and opened our eyes as to what's possible. That's essentially our answer to a replaceable blade knife, being that those have become so popular in the industry. We kicked around the idea, kind of hemmed and hawed as to whether or not it was something that we wanted to jump in on. And we're firm believers, and we're very proud in the fact that we build a knife that's meant to last. And so we don't want there to be any disposable element of what we do. We don't want to influence people to leave blades behind in the field. I've spent my fair share of time with replaceable knives, and I've seen it go south on people in bad situations. They're brittle, thin blades, and you'll watch them pop off in the meat, or people struggle to get them on and off the actual handle, which can be tough. So, that's the Altitude is our answer.
Cool. I don't have one of those. I think I had the Hidden Canyon, I think is what.
Yeah.
My one that I've used the most. I have a couple other knives, but I keep freaking losing them. I had one of the Pardues, I think it's called.
Yeah. Yep.
And I love that knife, and I lost that in the field.
I'm pretty darn good at losing knives too, so I feel your pain, and that's why I love the altitude. The thing's blaze orange, you know. It's when we were prototyping and designing that knife, we've got two colors of it. We have the orange, and then we have a black. We have a black version, and I prototyped that black version. I ended up killing a bull in Montana. It was like beautiful, sunny, early September, and I kept putting that thing down and struggling to find it again at times. So that orange, having that orange pop out is a big help.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I know some of the other ones you guys have orange handles on them. I don't know, actually. I'm pulling up your website here.
Yeah, the Steep Country.
Yeah, that's at the Steep Country. That's what it was.
Yep. Yeah, that's Steep Country is also a super popular knife. That's a knife that definitely leans more towards versatility than the altitude. The Steep Country is comfortable in hand. There's some people that don't like those minimalist skeletonized handles that the altitude has.
I'm actually a fan, to be honest with you, of skeleton stuff. I like to feel the handle.
Yeah. I am too. It's a scalpel. I like feel.
I like the weight reduction though. I mean, yep. It's like you can't have the best of both worlds.
Right. Totally. Some guys wrap that altitude in like a paracord. Naturally that paracord tends to get pretty gnarly after you work up one or two animals, and then you got to cut it off, redo it, so on and so forth. But some guys don't mind.
Yeah, well, for sure. So still sticking with the steel here. Aside from what you guys are using, can you talk to a little bit to the different types of steel and why one, you know, what's the pros and cons of them?
Sure. Yeah. You see a lot of like 420, a couple variations of this steel. It's 420A, 420C. And that's generally what you're going to find at like Walmarts and department stores and stuff like that. That's kind of the steel that's on knives that are hanging at the checkout counter. And that had been a very standard steel for a long time. There's 440s as well. And so that's a softer steel. It's not created through that powdered metallurgy process that something like S30 or S90 are manufactured through. And so they're not going to have that super even dispersion of carbides throughout the blade that we were talking about earlier. And so those knives are going to go dull faster. They're going to be very easy to sharpen because they are a softer steel. But you are going to be maintaining that edge more frequently. So that's a very common one. And then S30 is really becoming kind of the standard across the board. You're seeing a lot of companies work with it. It traditionally had been a relatively tough steel for manufacturers and small custom makers to machine. It just kind of eats up your tooling and your material and stuff like that. And so you saw the advent of a relative of S30V called the S35VN. And it's very similar in regards to its performance properties, but it was engineered because it is specifically easier to machine than S30. So for a lot of the smaller guys that don't have kind of the machinery or the tooling that we have in the factory at Benchmade, it gave them the ability to work with a steel that's going to perform at or around the level of what's becoming kind of the benchmark or the standard.
Cool. Can you talk to me a little bit about Damascus steel? Because you see that all the time, like on all these custom knife makers. Matter of fact, I got one in my hand right now that I'm looking at. It's so pretty to look at, but I'd never.
It's gorgeous.
I've never even taken it in the field. It's got some, like, copper in it too. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, Damascus has been around for a long time. And essentially, what's happening is you have two different alloys being folded together repeatedly throughout the forging process. And so there are some blades that are kind of like an etched Damascus. Someone's doing the actual pattern work themselves. But for the most part, that is truly two different steels that have been folded together repeatedly. And there are manufacturers out there and individual custom makers out there that are making it themselves. And they're inlaying these like beautiful patterns into the Damascus, and they're definitely more of an ornamental or decorative element to knife making. It's not something that you're going to see incredible performance out of compared to a lot of the super steels that we have today. And for the most part, we definitely do Damascus style blades at Benchmade. We use a specific manufacturer called Damasteel. They're out of Sweden. They're from this like super small town with an extensive history of steel manufacturing, like 500-600 years. And so they do essentially a stainless Damascus that doesn't require the same upkeep as your traditional Damascus steel would. And so it's going to perform at a level similar to a steel called 154 CM that used to be our baseline at Benchmade. And you still see that steel used in a bit of our legacy product. But over the past year or two, we've kind of been transitioning away from creating new knives with 154 CM and transitioning to S30V, like I had mentioned. So, yeah, Damasteel is awesome stuff. It looks super cool, but it's definitely not something that I recommend taking out in the field.
Gotcha. Yeah, a buddy of mine gave me this knife and as a gift, and I've never thought about it. It's super, super, super sharp. But
yeah, it's a little bit softer generally, so you can get a wicked edge on that stuff.
Yeah, it's probably sharper than my razor blade. Yeah, I always wondered about it. I always see guys like on Instagram a lot. There's so many knife makers and guys, you know, producing beautiful looking knives and stuff. I got an affliction for kitchen knives too, for some reason, because I'm always looking for a nice knife for cooking and whatever, and
yeah,
I'm always seeing these really cool stuff in them. I went off the edge over here a little bit. Anyway, so we kind of covered this a little bit. So when you're in the field, you're just using that the sharpener that you were talking about.
Yeah,
what is it about the leather? Like, how do you, I mean, I've never used it. I shouldn't say that, because I used it. My wife's grandfather gave me a straight razor from like 100-something years ago,
and yeah,
it's got the belt and everything that, you know.
Yep.
I never really mess with it very much. How does that work?
So you're essentially honing your edge with that leather strap. It's an imperative feature. I had neglected it for a long time, and it wasn't until I started working at Benchmade that I really understood the benefits of it. And so what you're doing is, once you've kind of honed your edge, and what's happening on a microscopic level is that absolute apex of your edge, as it dulls, is essentially rolling over itself. And so as you work your knife against a ceramic or diamond abrasive, you're kind of correcting that roll and bringing it back to true form. And once you've done that, you're creating a burr. And so you're progressively working your way down from the more aggressive abrasives to something a little more fine. And then the final step is just that leather strop. And so you're actually going to run your knife backwards, spine first against that leather, and you're knocking off any remainder of the burr and essentially taking away any material that might have built up on that edge after you've worked it across your rougher abrasives. You don't want little microscopic pieces of steel floating around and meat that you're about to eat.
Gotcha.
Sure, it's not going to hurt, but that's just kind of a final step there for honing, polishing, and finishing off that work that you've done prior to jumping on the leather.
So, I mean, this might sound like an obvious question, but how do you know that you've passed over the leather enough?
My test is, I've mentioned it, shaving arm hair, and I'll kind of run my finger across the edge and feel for a burr in any spots that I might have missed, depending on the geometry of the blade. If it's a little curved, or maybe out towards the tip, some people stop putting as much pressure on their sharpening at that point. And so you'll feel it might still feel dull. You might still have a little bit of a burr there. And so that's when I'll go back and hit it with the leather a couple times, see if I can knock it off with the leather. And if I can't, and I'm still feeling that rough kind of wired edge, I'll go back to a fine ceramic and then back to leather. And by that point, you've pretty much knocked down that burr and gotten yourself to a true clean point at the apex of that sharpened edge. So a lot of guys will run their finger gently across the sharpened edge. They'll run their thumb across it, and you almost want it to feel like glass. You don't want there to be any rough spots or little divots or nicks as you run your thumb across it. Naturally, don't put a lot of pressure on it as you're running your thumb on the sharp edge, but that's a good way to kind of tell if you've gotten to that absolutely perfect point.
Gotcha. So aside from your sharpening in the field, What are some of the things you're doing throughout the year to keep this knife optimal? What kind of knife care?
Yeah, a lot of people, you need to be very mindful of the environment in which you live and the steel that you have on your knife. So if you have a more corrosive steel and you're living in a more humid or coastal environment, you want to stay up on drying that knife every time before you store it. So I'll throw mine in the gun safe a lot of the times just because I have a dehumidifying rod in there. I know that if I put it away dry, it's going to stay dry and away from moisture in that environment. Now, like I said, a lot of the steels like S30 and S90, you've really got to try to get those things to rust out on you. So I'm a little more lax when it comes to keeping those knives dry and stashed away. But oil is never bad. You can do something as simple as like a light mineral oil to wipe down once you've cleaned your knife after working up an animal or just having a long weekend camping, hanging out with friends, whatever you're doing with that knife. And so you can even use Rem oil. A lot of guys have Rem oil sitting around from firearms, so you can use that on knives just the same. And that'll help provide a little bit of a protective layer against any kind of moisture or corrosion. It'll also help you clean that blade. So that's about as simple as it gets for me. And the cool thing about Benchmade is that we offer lifetime cleaning and sharpening. It's a free service. So what I generally recommend people do is get a knife into us a month or two before the season starts. We naturally see a pretty big intake spike right as we get closer to the season. I feel like myself included, most hunters are procrastinators. So we start seeing this flood of knives come in a couple weeks before seasons start kicking off around the West, and then the East Coast is not far behind. So get it into us. If you're not comfortable with doing it yourself, I mean, a lot of these guys spend a lot of money on our knives, and we understand that. So we want to provide a full service that truly reflects that cost and contributes to this knife being essentially an heirloom product. It stays in good shape. It's being handled by professionals and cared for by professionals, thus allowing it to stay in circulation longer. So a great, great service to take advantage of. It's super painless. And that service is provided to anybody that has a Benchmade, whether or not they're the original owner. I mean, you can find this thing on a trail, get it into us, and we'll bring it back to life. So,
no, that's awesome. It's funny. I didn't even know about that. I've had my knife, quote unquote, professionally sharpened a couple times by a guy here locally that sharpens all types of cutlery, but yeah, I didn't know that. I would have probably sent it in.
Yeah, it's a good service, and our turnaround time is pretty fast. It's generally like 7 to 8 business days, door to door. Obviously, that increases when we get into the busier months, but that way you're getting a factory sharpened edge on it. If you've got a folding knife, some guys, I personally work up all my animals with a fixed blade, just because I hate cleaning hide and fat out of folding mechanisms. And so if you are someone to use a folding knife, that's totally fine. You can send that thing into us, try to clean it as best you can. We get some pretty gnarly knives sent into us. Try to clean it up as best you can, send it in. We'll do complete disassembly. We use the sonic cleaners, same as you used for cleaning brass if you do your own reloading. And that really brings that thing back to life. We'll replace any internal mechanisms free of charge and really bring that folder back to its factory standard.
That's awesome. Yeah, me personally, like I carry three knives with me all the time. When I'm in the field, anyway, not day to day. I always carry one that's kind of like a, let's call it a survival knife in my, or multi-purpose knife.
Yep.
I carry that in my bino harness. That way, yep. If I'm separated from my bag, yada, yada, yada. And then I always carry a fixed blade. And I use that more for like deboning and working the meat more. But as far as skinning is concerned, I know you said you're against it, but I do use a replaceable blade. But I have my gripes with it. I have a lot of gripes with it. I've actually put some serious thought into developing my own.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a different conversation, I guess. But I feel like if you're going to be backpacking or whatever, and you don't want to carry the extra weight and have that, but for me, I'd rather carry the extra few ounces here and there. You know, I don't really do much backpack hunting anyway. I might spike out for a day or two, but I never really go deep into the yonder because my life doesn't allow me to. So I do most of my hunting is, within the vicinity, within 5-10 miles from a truck.
Totally.
Anyway, but
I do a lot of the same, here on the west, the Oregon's kind of bisected by the Cascades. And so the west side of the state's very temperate. You have a lot more rain. I love hunting Roosevelts. And so hunting those on the coast is awesome. There's really no wilderness per se, up here on the northern coast of Oregon. And so same deal. I'm doing day hunts. I'm usually mountain biking on closed logging roads. I'll carry a lightweight folder in my pocket. I'll carry my altitude with me. And then I'll generally have a machete back in the truck. A lot of the times these bigger Roosevelts are hanging down and super deep, gnarly, thick, creek bottoms and stuff like that.
I'm familiar with it.
Yep. And so I can get that.
A couple of years.
Yeah. It's a blast, man. I get to the end of every season. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take a break from the coast. I'm not doing that again. And then June rolls around and I'm like, I really want to go and just see which bulls are still out there, so on and so forth. And I end up spending like 20 days on the coast every bow season. So having that machete in the truck is super nice because if they do die in a total crap hole, I can take that first load out and then I can bushwhack a straight line A to B down into wherever that thing is and make myself a little makeshift trail and get myself out pretty quick. So
yeah, through the salmon berries.
It's so gnarly. I mean, there's even times where I'll go in ahead of season. If I've kind of figured out a couple bulls, that's a cool thing about Roosevelts is that they're pretty territorial. And so if they're undisturbed, they'll stay in the same comfort zone within like a mile or two radius for as long as they can. And so if I start figuring out these little creek bottoms and stuff like that they're living before the season starts, I'll go in and cut some trails closer to those areas so that I can essentially bugle from the road, locate them when they are ready to pop off, and then I can just go silent and sneak in and get as close as I can to their little safety net. And that's when I start lighting up with a bugle and really trying to get that thing mad and comfortable with leaving the cows that he might be bedded with to come and party with me.
Nice. Yeah, the last 2 years I've hunted with the guys from Angry Spike in Oregon.
Those guys have it absolutely dialed.
Yep, they know what they're doing. That's for sure.
They truly do. They are they're impressive to watch. They're a big part of why I got so stoked on Roosevelts. As I kind of got to the West and started consuming this like Northwest media, and obviously the born and raised guys are big time Roosevelt hunters, and then Angry Spike, those guys just get it done year after year.
Yeah, no, for sure. They're super awesome dudes. So Well, I want to end this podcast. I didn't prep you for this, so
okay.
I wanted to ask you to share with us one of your favorite hunting stories.
Favorite hunting stories. Gosh, I'd say, I think my first time ever doing a big like backpack hunt. I got a tag in Montana. I was living in Oregon at the time, and I just like pinched all my time off. I think I had like 15 or 20 days to give it. I had an elk and deer tag. I went out there with one buddy, and we were swinging blind. We didn't scout. We didn't do anything. There had been bad fires that summer. So I think the first like two or three spots that we had picked out on Onyx ahead of time just were loaded up with trucks at the trailhead. So we kind of like just kept bouncing around and finally found a spot that only had a few trucks. And like at that point, I've driven out from Oregon 12, 13 hours in the car, gotten screwed on plans A, B, and C, but that's hunting. You can't help but be a little dejected. And so it was smoking hot. We packed in. I think we actually slept at the trucks that night because we had been so late bouncing from trailhead to trailhead. And so we slept in the trucks, woke up the next morning. I think we made it like an hour, and light was just starting to break, and I heard a bull crack off. We had just glassed this big canyon from a ridge that we had come up on. It was kind of the first canyon that we saw, and a bull cracked off unsolicited. I hadn't bugled, I hadn't done anything. Nice. I ripped back at him, and he was far enough away you couldn't really tell whether or not he was an elk or a hunter. And so I ripped back at him. He went silent for a couple minutes, and then he was like right under us and had just absolutely cruised uphill through this country to us. At that point I was like, there's no way a human could have made it this quick up to where we are now.
Right.
Long story short, I shot him at like 7 yards, 5-10 minutes later. And I was done with my elk tag in an hour. And so I was kind of mind blown. I was like, I know I've got a deer tag, my buddy's got a tag, but like, I've got 14 days left. This is just unbelievable for me. And so I busted that thing up. We started working the animal up, and I skewered my hand with the altitude, incredibly bad. And so I was trying to like jimmy a quarter into one of those tighter game bags, and like an idiot had the knife in one hand and my left hand kind of gripping the base of that quarter. And it just all kind of slipped, and I brought my hands together and just rammed that altitude into the palm of my hand. And so we tape it up, try to get ourselves squared away. And as we're putting our packs on to turn and pack out, my buddy puts his hand down on the ground, and somebody else's old broadhead was on the ground there.
Jesus Christ.
And so he rams his hand, and we're both taped up. We've got like bandanas wrapped around each of our hands, and we're packing this elk out with, we each have our hands over our head because they're throbbing so bad. And so we both look just totally goofy, one hand over our head, walking these packs out. And I think we had gone like 4 or 5 miles at that point. And so we're trying to get back to the truck, and we run into a bunch of locals, and they just, I mean, the looks on their faces, seeing these guys walking with like one hand over each of their heads with an elk on their back, was just, the looks on their faces was priceless. It was awesome. And so we ended up having to go get stitched up. Both of us ended up having to go get stitched up, and, we packed that bull up for the rest of the day. It was an awesome time. I shot an awesome mule deer the next day. and just got super lucky. So that was like the best trip I've ever done, a little good, a little bad. And then we had kind of 13 days to work my buddy's tags. We got him filled, and we had an absolute blast.
That's awesome.
So I'd say that's probably one of my most memorable hunting experiences. Usually I'm kind of a last day, last couple day kind of guy. But I am an opportunistic hunter. So if something legal steps in front of me on the first day, I'm probably going to shoot it.
Yeah. I'm kind of in the same, of the same school of thought right there. I don't know. In the last 2 years, I've kind of leaned more to, I don't want to say the word trophy hunter, but I've been a little bit more picky.
Sure. Yeah, I think that mentality kind of transitions from Roosevelt hunting for me. There's so few opportunities. They are pretty darn hard to hunt. And so, like any opportunity I get with a Roosevelt, I'm going to take it. When I go east of the mountains and start hunting Rocky Mountain elk, it's a different story. You're generally going to get more opportunities depending on where you are. So it's not as common for me to swing on the first pitch when I'm hunting east of the mountains. But you just can't help yourself sometimes.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, cool, man. I want to thank you for coming on and spending some time with us and shedding some light on the subject.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. I guess, where can our listeners find out more about you and look into? I mean, go to benchmade.com for sure, but
yep.
Find out more about what you got going on.
Yeah, benchmade.com is a big one. I'm on the social media there a lot too. That's one of my main kind of focuses at the company. So the Benchmade Knife Company Instagram, and I'm pretty quiet on social outside of that. I like to keep a low profile. So those are generally the best touch points to find me.
Sweet. All right, man. Well, I don't know if you got much of season left to do, but I hope you you do well for the rest of the season, and we'll catch up with you, I'm sure.
Thanks, John. The feeling's mutual. Good luck to you, and thanks again. Really appreciate the opportunity.
For sure. Hey, guys. Want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me. And you could go on there. On the top right-hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there, a lot of posts that go hand in hand with the podcast that we do, plus gear reviews, plus we have the signature t-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food t-shirts, and the Tuesday Kuzday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.